Hello, welcome to What a Waste of Time. I'm Jim, here's Nick.
Hello, it's me, Nick, speaking to you in the year of our Lord, 2020.
First podcast of the new year. And yeah, so the subject this time is one I've been trying to figure out what the name of this thing I want to talk about is for a while.
You've been trying to articulate this to me on many an occasion where you've gone, well, it's like this thing, you know? And I say, is it this? You go, no, not that! And I say, but it sounds like that. You're like, yes, but not that, though!
It's like, yeah.
So this is going to be an adventure for me, listener, as much as it is for you.
Okay.
Give us the pitch, Jim.
So the name of the thing that I have settled on is Intertextual Fan Service. I'm going to start the timer now.
Oh, just after, straight away.
Yeah. So
let's get this new year rolling.
It's like, because in our first conversation about it, I just called it fan service. And of course, fan service conjures up a whole bunch of other like types of things more associated with that term.
Titties.
Number one on the list, yes. But I'm talking about this sort of specific, like, I think it's happening a lot in our media nowadays because we have a lot of stuff that's either from some sort of legacy franchise where either it's gone on for a long time or it's an adaptation of something that's already in the cultural zeitgeist. And so I'm seeing a lot of stories with moments that are clearly like intended to provoke a reaction from the audience because it presumes that they're already familiar with another text.
Now, when you say another text, you mean earlier iterations of the same franchise?
Yes, or something that's very closely associated with it.
Like in the same way that the end credit things in all the Marvel movies back in the day, it was like, I'm Nick Fury and I want to talk to you about the Avengers. Whereas, you know, in the actual text of the Iron Man movie, like, Nick, you don't know what a Nick Fury is or who an Avengers are.
Yeah.
But you're like, oh, it's the thing from comics!
Yeah.
Oh, see that! It's got Captain America.
Yeah. It's that kind of thing, and that I don't mind. Films that are starting a new franchise have, like, moments like that. I'm thinking of the Ghostbusters, like, end credit scene where it's like, what's Zool? And, of course, that's meant to make the audience go, oh, I know what a Zool is. They're going to do Zool. And they're like, yeah, we're going to do a sequel. We want a sequel so bad. Please let us have a sequel.
And then all the men said, no.
Yeah.
Give us one where it's the old men again.
Yeah. The worst type of this thing...
this intertextual fan service.
Whatever, yeah.
Your term.
This.
Coined and minted.
Yeah, it doesn't really roll.
A Jim Woodall
doesn't
original.
Roll off the tongue, though, does it? the example I have been giving is Star Trek Into Darkness, they capture Benedict Cumberbatch, who up until this point had been playing villain John Harrison, I think.
John Carter.
I just remember he has the same name as the man who invented the chronometer. And I'm like, is that intentional? I don't know. They capture him. They put him in a glass prison because that is what you do when you capture a bad guy now.
You're going to have your Hannibal Lecter moment.
It's a force field prison. And I suppose that was sort of precedented in Star Trek. But still, it's that trope. And then he reveals, like, my name is not John Harrison, it's Khan. And all the audience goes, oh, this was a Khan movie all along. It's that character.
Even though
J.J.
Abrams was like, it's definitely not Khan.
Yes, even though he said it's definitely not Khan.
I'm lying to you, it's not Khan. No Khan here. Look how white he is. Khan's not white.
Then all the characters in that scene go,
who the fuck's Khan?
Who? I don't know. Khan is completely new to me. And the reason why that bothers me, at least in the way it's used in that story, and I think it's used that way a lot, is, as you said, J.J. Abrams flatly denied that it was a Khan film. So if you structure your your story around this quote-unquote hashtag moment where you want the audience to react to the thing that they're already familiar with, that means you can't sell the story for what it is. You have to do this sort of deception where it's like, we had to say, oh, this isn't a Khan film. It's a Benedict Cumberbatch plays John Harrison. We have to give him another name. We have to say, oh, look, it's about this other thing.
And poor Cumberbuns on all of the press tour has to be going, yes, well, playing John Harrison was incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
You know, penguins.
Penguins. and, yeah, so that means you can't advertise the story you're telling. You have to pretend it's a different story so you can preserve that moment of surprise. And that's a bit weird because it's not really part of the story in the same way as, like, because it doesn't affect the, like, the characters don't know who Khan is. That and it's this weird sort of, like, structuring the story because you know how the audience is going to react to it.
Or at least you hope how the audience
will
react.
Yeah. Rather than, like, it just, like, it feels like often that's done at the expense of telling a story that's true to the characters or themes or what have you. This was prompted by the first two episodes of the new series of Doctor Who. Series, like, I do want to shit on the new series of Doctor Who thus far. There have been four episodes. It is a shame. I do want to disclaimer before this because it's very difficult to criticize Doctor Who nowadays without it being lumped in with a lot of bad faith criticism that people don't like Jodie for whatever reason or.
There's just something about her, Jim. I can't put my finger on what it is, but when I look at her, I just go, I don't know. I just don't think that she's a very good doctor. I can't. There's nothing, bras. I don't know. Something like that.
So, yeah, before I criticise Doctor Who, I do want to put that disclaimer in that, like, I'm not lumping my criticism in with that. I thought it was a great idea when Jodie Whittaker was cast, and I felt there was some...
Sorry, it's very amusing. It was like, if anyone's listened to this podcast before, I'm not sure they're like, well, I've always suspected that Jim was a misogynist. You know? But now that he doesn't like Doctor Who, this is the thing that's going to make me flip on this.
I mean, this is the world we live in now. Where people
you don't want to get Me Too, Jim. You know, watch out.
But, the previous series was okay. I thought there were some standout episodes. Rosa was excellent.
Well, the thing I think that when we talked about it at the time, off mic, and... I think the thing that we both were kind of agreed for is that what they'd done in the Doctor Who episode, which was a little bit distinct from the Khan example, is that the Khan example, the plot is all the same as Khan, but you have this one moment where he goes, oh, and actually I'm Khan, which is a moment, a singular moment for the fans. And you have a certain amount of advertising material that is like, it's definitely not Khan. And you're like, I can't believe it's Khan. What a journey I've been on as an audience member. And I'm like, this is so empty and meaningless. But... whereas the thing that we came away with from the Doctor Who episode is that the whole build-up of the first episode was into the reveal of the Master being back again.
Yes.
And the thing that we were kind of going is that, like, the problem was is that while we weren't necessarily against the Master being back again, we did have some misgivings.
And there is a precedent for the Doctor, like, for the Master appearing in disguise. So it wasn't exactly...
part of his gimmick.
Yeah.
But the thing that we kind of agreed on is that the whole rest of the plot seemed to be doing something completely different and less interesting, but nonetheless it took an awful lot of setting up. Like, you know, Lenny Henry is a surveillance capitalist who's made a deal with some extra-dimensional aliens to upgrade humanity into, like, energy things to bring these people through because he let his DNA get changed into one of the part of the alien people and he really resents his mum, who never really liked him ever since he left Doncaster and got all Hollywood with all of his tech billionaires. He apparently at some point met the Master who was like, oh, 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 I'm the Master, I'm gonna... want to kill the Doctor, and Lady Henry's was like, who? And then that plot has to resolve, which it does, kind of, through the Doctor just turning up and being like, oh, actually, I fixed it with a thing, and now it's done. And we're like, what was the point of... Hold on, I mean, you had a really fun plot where it could have just been like, the Master's back, and he's chasing the Doctor across history. Stop!
Yeah,
That's enough idea. And it's sort of the two-way thing. I think the thing that I feel like we're kind of reaching towards here is that there's always a lot of media weight put upon the idea of shocking your audience or a surprising twist. And in this case, the surprising twist is we brought back fan-favourite character, the Master, and he's played by a sexy new guy, and he's very good.
Yes.
Yeah, we liked him.
I really liked Sacha Dhawan, I think his name is.
Yeah. But the thing of it is that the Khan example is everyone knew it was Khan, because it was obviously Khan, and J.J. Abrams had to go, it's not. And we're like, but it is. Yeah. Then the movie comes out, and lo and behold, it was. So that's just like, oh, okay, so you were trying to generate a mystery box, J.J., and it turns out there was not one there. Whereas the Doctor Who one was the opposite, where they actually didn't reveal that the Master was back in any way, shape or form in the pre-production. So it was a surprise, but the problem was is that they took so much effort to obfuscate that and build up this whole superstructure surrounding narrative that they still had to resolve.
Yeah.
So they did get there, because I had a friend of mine who's not like a massive Doctor Who fan, but she actually texted me that evening, be like, oh my god, did you see Doctor Who? The Master's back! When they revealed who it was, I literally screamed, oh my god! Like, she was very, like, it landed for her. Like, super good. And the problem was, is that for at least for our experience, it was like, oh cool, it's the Master. What the fuck have we been doing for this whole episode? Sure hope they resolve a lot of this in episode 2. Nope.
Yeah. So this is, like, In the sort of marketing, like, lead up to Doctor Who coming back, it felt a little off for me even then, because it had been quite a big gap between this series and the last series, and you know the first episode of any series does sort of need to serve as like in a way. The mission statement for this series. What is this series going to be about?
Moody Doctor.
Yes, and that this story, at least, because it went over 2 episodes, did do that. But
also spies.
But that's the thing. That's what felt odd to me. It's just like, okay, so Doctor Who has not been on for over a year, and now we're back. And what is going to be our draw to bring in our old audience and new audiences? And it was just like, we're doing James Bond.
It's a gimmick episode.
And that's the thing, a lot of the promotional material like wasn't for the entire series. It was about that opening story. It was all, we're doing James Bond. To the point where I even doubted, like, are they going to broadcast the entire series now? Or is it just these 2 episodes? I like the idea of, like, oh yeah, like Doctor Who doing James Bond, that's not been done before, that can be entertaining. I think it might work better if you said it in the 60s, but never mind.
That'd be cool. Yeah, I wouldn't bother that.
But what felt odd to me is that Doctor Who does James Bond felt like a mid-season episode.
Yeah.
Because it's not a mission statement. It's just we're doing this fun thing. But watching that first episode, realizing that, oh, you were leading up to this Master reveal, but you couldn't say it was the Master, so you had to put something else in front of that.
Yeah.
Because you know, that's the thing you had to put in all of your marketing. So that's what the James Bond thing is for, which is why the episode, the whole story comes across as a bit odd, because the James Bond thing is very quickly buried under interdimensional aliens, which I also think is a great idea. I've always loved the idea of the Doctor facing against eldritch beings from outside the universe and therefore outside their understanding. I was like, they did a whole reveal where there's like, oh, where are you from? Another planet? We're from another universe. And the Doctor's like, oh, I have no idea how to deal with that. I thought, oh, that's really cool. If that's the story they're going with, I might be on board with this. And then they buried that underneath the Master reveal, which means that, like, while we both like raved to the idea of the Master chasing the Doctor across history, which was the sort of the main plot of the second episode, it meant they still had to deal with a lot of the companions are still doing the James Bond thing, even though it doesn't really affect anything else. And also interdimensional aliens are there, but all they do is kind of show up every now and then the Graham tap dances his laser shoes. We don't see how they get out of that situation, and then it was fine.
I'm going to pull you back to the point of the podcast.
But my point of that statement is that, like, I see that the story was structured in that way, because it was built around this hashtag moment, this master reveal. So they had to front load it with lots of other stuff, and that meant it sort of couldn't be about what it wanted to be about.
Hmm. I mean, the thing that you've expressed to me in other conversations, the thing that you kind of wanted to get at, is the nature of writers using legacy franchises where they want to have these, for lack of a better term, Easter eggs.
Mm.
And I think, unfortunately, this means we're going to have to talk about Marvel. Because, you know, I think part of the whole way that this economy has grown up is due to the Marvel shared universe model.
No, I agree.
Being as wildly successful as it is. And it's like, you go back to, like, literally, you know, like I said, in the example of Iron Man, from day one, they were seeding this idea that, oh, there are more things that you don't know about.
Mm.
But we know that people who read the comics are going to be like, oh, I could have drawn Avengers! Oh, look, they found a big hammer in the desert! That means it's a Thor! You know, and other people are going to be like, oh, I wonder what this is about. And it's a thing to create buzz.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, you've got the whole sort of cottage industry of, you know, 12 things in the new Marvel trailer that you missed, crudely circled the thumbnail on YouTube of an arrow and someone going, oh,
yeah.
You know, that kind of stuff. And I think what we're noticing, or I think the thing that you expressed to me, is that we're seeing writers trying to, rather than like, we've made an Iron Man and we've put an entirely separate post-credits blah,
mm.
on the end so people can go, oh, there's another, okay, there's the next one coming. And what we're seeing now more is that writers for legacy media stuff seem to be pivoting more towards the tacked on bit at the end as the main draw, like, yeah. The whole look at what we're trying to set up here with our cool stuff. And that's not good writing wise because it means you're built in service of an implication rather than in terms of an actual solid film all on its own.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the issue to me, is that is when the story is built around that moment, that means you sort of have this story that's pulling itself in two different directions, where it's deliberately trying to disguise itself as something it's not, which means it has to spend a lot of time on the thing that it's not actually interested in. And then you have that reveal, and it's like, oh, look, it turns out this is what I am.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's also like, this also prompted by, like, because Rise of Skywalker had a lot of moments like that where
I haven't seen it.
Yeah, and I don't,
and I refuse to see it.
And I've been thinking about it and just realizing, well, like that was also true of The Force Awakens, that it did a similar thing, where it was trying to hide the fact that Rey was the main character in the way it was marketed, in the fact, like, because they wanted to preserve that moment where she, you know, force pulls the lightsaber out of, well, you think it's Kylo Ren doing it, but then the lightsaber flies past him and she catches it, and then lightsaber battle ensues, and the way they sort of, like, and it's a great moment, but the way they try to make that moment a surprise is in all of the marketing before that film came out. You only ever saw John Boyega, or his character Finn, holding the lightsaber. I even remember when he was on Graham Norton, he was the only one who was asked about lightsaber training, and they gave him a toy lightsaber, and he did a demonstration with it, and he nearly hit Kylie Minogue. I think it was Kylie Minogue. He nearly hit someone. But Daisy Ridley was there. Like, she was never asked about this because it was deliberately buried in the marketing so that that moment could be a surprise.
See, I think that that's two different things, though.
The reason I mentioned that as relevant to this is that I think it causes a similar problem in that I wonder if, like, because, you know, Rey, there's been a lot of backlash to her as a character. I wonder if it's because the film, like, was never sold as her story, even though the trilogy as a whole is built around her. The first moment that J.J. Abrams conceived was the moment with Luke handing her the lightsaber. No.
Luke the lightsaber.
That moment. Yeah. Like, that was the first moment he conceived. He built the story around it. It is Rey's story. And yet it wasn't sold as Rey's story.
I mean, this is asking me to remember marketing campaigns for Star Wars movies. In my opinion, I don't feel that Rey was ever necessarily obfuscated in that way. Like, the majority of the stuff I remember from the trailers that I saw was that it was presented as a kind of ensemble piece. Like, there didn't seem to be a particular thing of building out any particular character to be the main. And it also, because it did have that whole massive momentum of being, it's the first new Star Wars since George Lucas is no longer in control. We promise you it's not going to be like the prequels. Mm. But it also had that very, like, kind of, oh, it's so hallowed, and, like, look at your beautiful fatted calf being returned from the mountain in glory! And you had, like, it meant that they could do the thing that the first trailer for Man of Steel did really well, where the actual trailer is very little to do with telling you anything that the movie's actually about, but is about mood. Yeah. Like, the first trailer for Man of Steel is brilliant. Like, and it made me go, oh, fuck, this movie looks like it might be right, because it's this sort of weird, wistful kind of montage-based thing that's all about, like, the ideas of the character, or rather the feeling or the idea of the franchise, rather than any particular plot beats.
True.
There's no bit where someone turns to the camera and goes, hang on, everybody! And then you see them flying through an asteroid field. You're like, oh, that means there's an action set piece there.
Yeah.
Like, it was much more loose and disjointed and sedate pacing. So,
yeah, that's fair.
But equally, I would also say is I still don't think that's necessarily the same thing, at least in the way that our pre-show discussions were, because it's the thing that you initially were complaining about was the notion of having a textual element of the film that is meant to be impactful, but no one within the setting of the story really has any context for it. Because, for example, the difference between Master and Khan is that the Doctor knows who the Master is, and the companions could be like, who's the Master? And then the Doctor, oh, well, he's my best friend / fuck buddy / you know, girlfriend, wife, I don't know. It's all very confusing. That kind of thing. And meanwhile, Khan, they're like, who?
Yeah.
And it's like, J.J. Abrams points at the screen going, look, it's Khan. And we're like, we know, J.J., we know.
Yeah, I mean, I saw a YouTube video, I think it was by Just Right, that sort of talked about the Rise of Skywalker, but also about how J.J. Abrams sort of does this thing in general, but particularly egregiously in The Rise of Skywalker. And the moment that that they discussed was at the end of The Rise of Skywalker, there's a sort of like epilogue scene where Rey returns
to... I'm Rey Star Wars.
yes, Rey Star Wars returns to Tatooine, to Luke's childhood home, and buries Luke's lightsaber and... Leia's lightsaber, which we've been told exists,
remember all that training for a Jedi she did off screen.
And this video pointed out that for Rey, to pick the Skywalker name, like her context for Skywalker, for the House of Skywalker, is Kylo Ren, Darth Vader, the two most evil people in the galaxy, Luke, who disappointed her. And then Leia, but she points out that maybe it would make more sense for her to pick the name Organa, since Leia spent more time training her than any Skywalker ever did. And she never lived on Tatooine, she lived on Alderaan.
Can't bury lightsabers there.
No, it's true. Maybe just drop it out the airlock.
Leave it into space.
And I've seen, an amusing comic that I don't remember the artist of that sort of, like, had Leia and Luke's Force Ghost in that scene, with Luke going, I hated it here, and Leia going, where's this?
Yeah, where are we now?
And
isn't this where I shot those droids?
And that's that moment, like... Makes,
it's for the audience.
It's purely for the audience, and it doesn't make much sense to the character. And I think that's less impactful.
Yeah. Because this is, I mean, I wanted to talk a bit about, like, the origins of the terminology of fan service. Because, listener, you might not know that the term fan service, as it currently exists now, is a little bit different to what it was back in the day. Because if you were back in the early 2000s and people talked to you about fan service, you were talking about softcore anime pornography. That's what it was. And the idea was that fan service was to give the fans things they want, and because anime is a trash genre for trash people, this meant usually underage girls with improbably large bosoms getting them out. And, like, you even have stuff that in the Neon Genesis Evangelion even did the masterful thing during the show of they'd have the next time on Evangelion, and you would have was it Misato saying, this is some of the stuff that's going to happen. And it would always finish up saying, and maybe if you're lucky, there'll be a little fan service for you. Mm. Like, deliberately calling out the fans and being all like, oh, hey, yeah, we're definitely going to show you some titties. And then there were seldom any titties. If there were, they were sad and uncomfortable titties. And you were like, I wanted this, but not in this way.
Not like this.
Not like this.
Not like this.
But yeah, it's about the idea of catering specifically with more window dressing stuff rather than plot points to give the fans things that they think that they want. And it's like, you look at the very successful careers of someone like Hiro Mashima, who a lot of people in the manga community is like, he should just draw some porn. It'd probably do him good to just get it out there. He really wants to. It's clear. It's very, very clear he wants to draw some porn. But he never will. He'll always just be like, and then all of, like, much like Ken Akamatsu, he's just like, I'm having a really good sci-fi action adventure, and then all of their clothes fall off. And they try and cover up.
But I've seen everything.
But it's too late, because our protagonist has seen everything.
I mean, do we really want to be quoting Ricky Gervais in this day and age?
I choose to ascribe, Extras is still...
Death of the Author.
And also, Extras is still a good show. It's a good show. Like, because he didn't play himself. And also...
You're taking this podcast to places I don't want to go.
No, but I think what we've seen is that even within anime and manga, like, they've done... We do have shows that are just fan service shows. You look at, like, a manga series like Parallel Paradise.
Mm.
Don't stop. Put down the... Don't watch. Don't read it. It's bad. I actually read a couple of chapters of it. Because it was came up on the thing on the manga site that I read. They have like hot manga right now, what people are reading, you know. And I always have a look at that because it's sometimes a good way to keep track of what the community at large is reading and sort of also things to be like, well, I don't think I need to read that. And I was like, I don't know what this Parallel Paradise thing is. I started reading it. I was like, oh, it's an isekai. Isekai is the concept of I was thrust into a fantasy world, but I'm from the modern world, and my knowledge of modern stuff gives me untold advantages in this fantasy video game-esque world, and I'm the hero. Oh, where's my harem of improbably attractive ladies, blah, you know. That's the genre. I hate isekai. There's so much of it, and generally it's all really boring. Parallel Paradise is an isekai where guy has a magic penis basically, and if there's this disease going around that the entirely female population die when they turn like 18, or no, I think when they turn 20, and the only way to save them is if he has sex with them. And I read a couple of chapters, like, I see what this is. Okay. No. But that is fan service as plot, where the whole thing is the vicarious experience of reading about a character who's just like you or me, a slightly nebbish, awkward Japanese school kid who wants to have sex with girls, but is just somehow too awkward and never could get it together. But then he's thrust into a world where he's the only magical penis man in the world. And you're like, well, this is satisfying on a very, like, you know, basic level. That is fan service's plot.
Yeah, men are allowed their fantasies.
Hey, everyone's allowed to have your spank banks. It's fine. Don't worry about it. But the thing of it is that you have fan service as plot infiltrating into these big legacy things, which are like, you know, billion-dollar franchises, where it's sort of like, I kind of get what you're going for, that you want to... It's sort of like in the same way that, if I can use the fighting game community as an example, is that fighting games generally are played to an extremely high level by a very, very few people who actually do this sort of thing for tournament stuff. But it's the demonstrations of skill, it's the passion, it's the entire scene built around these people who play the game to the highest level that keep people like me, who are trash, like, interested in it, and I still buy the games. I buy the games, and I play them for a bit, and I try and get better, and it's difficult, so I don't compete or anything like that, but I'm still brought in by the most passionate fans, for lack of a better term, of that genre. Mm. And it's partly the community that surrounds that gets me in. Same thing with comics. When all the comics nerds go, oh my god, they're going to do Thanos! And everyone's like, what's a Thanos? That, oh my god, you wait! And it builds buzz. Yeah. And, you know, because, I mean, if you look at Avengers, it's like, when we see Thanos at the end going, I need to get my glove out of a box off my chair. You know, way back in, like, Avengers 1 or whatever the fuck it was.
Yeah.
No, most people were like, well, who's this big purple guy? Who the fuck's happening here? Yeah. Why is he played by Josh Brolin? And it's all about building buzz, because buzz gets people into cinemas, it gets people spending money,
yeah.
It gets people engaged. Is it viable? Does it work? Yes.
Clearly it does.
It does. Do we know how much money Rise of Skywalker made?
I mean, a lot.
Yeah.
I
mean, it's about Star Wars.
Yeah.
You know, unless you're Solo. You're going to make money.
I don't, like, everyone talks about Solo having bombed, even though, like...
It made money.
Like, in terms of Star Wars?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
In terms of cinema, it did very, very well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. In terms of Star Wars. Oh, you didn't break the top 10 highest grossing movies ever?
You didn't smash box office records?
Oh.
Ew.
God, how disgusting. It's so awkward. No one even likes that.
You can't sit with us!
Go away, Solo. You're a disgrace to the family name.
You sit on your own table, Solo.
Ah!
No, don't know that.
No, I like that. Keep that in. Don't cut that.
I'm not going to cut it.
But yeah, I think it's endemic of the idea of trying to cater to a fan base, which we've talked about a little bit before.
Yeah.
Which is a thing that you can, and in some cases should, do.
Yes.
You do want to give fan service in the sense that you want to show the fans things that they want to see.
Yes.
Because that's what they're going to pay you money for, to go see your movie, read your comic, read your book, not write your book. That's your crowdsourcing. And that's... that's the idea. You want to have fans and you want to do things that they like with the stuff that you make. However, you can't build a narrative on just the implied promise of what it represents.
Yeah, especially because often you don't deliver on those promises, because then the next thing is still about trying to build the promise of what's to come instead of paying off the promises you've already made.
Have we had any Marvel movies since Endgame yet? Have any come out?
Spider-Man? Wasn't there Spider-Man Far From... Oh, no, wait, was that before Endgame?
Because I thought it came out before Endgame, but it's set after? I didn't see it, because I stopped watching. But the thing I found interesting is that, like, Endgame is an interesting experiment, because it's, like, 26-odd movies or whatever of build,
yeah.
You know, with micro-narratives within.
Mm.
And then it does its big... And then, all of them! Look at all the portals open with all of them! Look at all of them together! They're all there! All of the action figures! Clonk, 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 you know, knocking them together and, you know, using karate chop action with Thor and all that kind of stuff. And it's like, now they've done that, I'm really quite... curious in the sense that I don't want to watch any of the movies.
Curious from a distance.
Yeah, I would not want to be the person who has to think, okay, what's the next 10 years of Marvel meant to be? Because ideally you need to start doing build again.
Yeah.
But a lot of what made Marvel so electric is that there was so much stuff that wasn't yet in it. It's like, you know, back when it was just Iron Man... Then they said, oh, hey, the Avengers are going to be a thing at some point. You're like, okay, cool. And then they're like, also, we're bringing in Thor. We're like, he's in the Avengers, of course. Mm-hmm. And then every time you had a little tease, it usually meant that there would be another property.
Yeah.
But on paper, I would say that they're about at capacity, right? Like, there's not, you can't. I mean, they're going to do the only one I'm paying attention to is Shang-Chi, which is a new property, which I'm like, yeah. But also, Shang-Chi, no disrespect to Shang-Chi, he's never going to carry, like, the Marvel stamp. He's not your new Iron Man. He's not your new Captain America. He's a kung fu boy who fights good. That's his whole gimmick. And, you know, I'm happy we're getting a Shang-Chi movie, and I hope it's fucking just brutal and insane and is just a 90-minute fight scene. That's all I want. But, again, that's not really the kind of thing that really I think is going to get people being like, oh, I'm super buzzed about, you know, whatever. Like, the consistent drive to try and make Ant-Man a thing, you know, where they just keep throwing money and going, no, you will like this. And people are like, just these movies aren't very good.
I mean, I'm not going to jump on that opinion because I've not seen either of them.
The first one's like, fine. The second one is, I was actively furious.
Really?
Because the thing is, right, I got lied to on the internet. I mean, who would have thought? Someone on the internet being lies. And they said, oh, there's all of this crazy quantum world stuff.
I remember you saying.
Yeah, because the quantum world bit in Ant-Man 1 was my favourite bit in that film.
Yeah.
It got really weird, and I was like, oh, this is cool, I'd like more of this. And then what actually happens is that there's not much quantum world shit in Ant-Man 2, and it sucks. It's just awful, and it was like 2 hours of my life that I will never get back. But I don't think Marvel can build... They can't expand their empire on the same gimmick of promising new stuff. Because we're already pretty far into the weeds at this point.
Yeah, and like, and that's not to say there's still plenty... I mean, I'm speculating because obviously... I'm sure there's still plenty of interesting properties within the whole Marvel canon to adapt.
Great Lakes Avengers. I want Flatman.
But we're starting to get to the point where, like, you know, we've done all the biggest names, and so now, and but also, like, even if they do, like, oh now we're doing this big one, I think it becomes less effective the more you do it.
Yeah.
Because it's just like, oh, who's this one now?
We saw bunch of smaller movies get into a big Avengers.
Yeah.
Bunch of big Avengers get into a bigger Avengers, and then every single movie coalesce into Infinity War, an Endgame, Super Avengers movie. There are no more mountains for them to climb. Like, you reach the peak of peak saturated superhero stuff.
I mean,
and you did it. Like, fair balls to you. You did it. But also, okay, now what?
There's a similar thing in Doctor Who, in Russell T Davies' era, when, like, sort of the culmination of his, like, because it was his last full series, the finale of season 4 is kind of doing a similar thing, in that...
I don't know where...
Sorry, this is the one with Catherine Tate as
Donna. Oh, no!
And it ends with the Daleks stealing the Earth, and every companion comes back.
Is it out... No, this isn't out of time. End of time.
Journey's End is what it's called.
Is it the one where Tennant died?
No, that's okay. This is the finale to his last full series before he did the 2000 specials. And Rose is back, and Martha comes back.
Rose
and,
has a gun.
Yeah, and her family's back, and then the thing that tipped it over the end for me was just that and Sarah Jane is in it. And Torchwood, so all of the spin-off shows, they're in it as well. There's a lot going on. And then it's just like, oh, someone says some technobabble. And Doctor's like, oh, that's going to be difficult to solve. And Sarah Jane's like, oh, wait, I have something to show you. And then, look, here's K-9. And K-9 is here, appears. I can solve that problem. Solves the problem. We never see K-9 again. And I just remember thinking, like, that moment purely exists because people like K-9.
Yeah.
And he wasn't allowed to be in the Sarah Jane Adventures because of certain rights, agreements that were then resolved by Journey's, by the time they made that episode Journey's End. So they had to put K-9 in for a moment. And so they invented a problem just with some complicated-sounding language. K-9 appeared, did some more complicated sounding language, which solved the other complicated sounding language.
And the announcer said, look at him go!
Yeah.
We'll see him again at some point, bye!
And it's that sort of thing that irritates me, because I'm just like, that doesn't work on me. Like, maybe it's just because I don't have, like, the emotional connection to
K-9. You didn't grow up with K-9.
No, I didn't grow up with K-9. But still, even, like, all the other characters, like, I love this show, and, I really enjoyed Rose and her family and all that dynamic, and so when they all came back, I was like, oh, this is nice. But it never fully landed for me, because them just being there wasn't enough. And the fact that so many of them were there meant you couldn't really explore any of their emotional arcs in any depth, because you didn't have as much time to spend with everyone.
Yeah.
Especially, like, here's K-9, he's there for, like, a minute.
Can I just contrast this? Because after we watched the new series of Jodie Whittaker thing, we actually went and watched, at Jim's suggestion, two episodes from Peter Capaldi's.
Yeah, it was Peter Capaldi's last series. Before, not including the Christmas special, his, like, the finale of his last series, which the episodes were, The Doctor Falls was the second one, and the first one was the one with the black hole, and they're on a colony ship.
The Cyberman one. Yeah,
yeah. And time is running at different speeds.
But the thing of it is that watching that, because I'd seen the Christmas special that came after that in isolation, because he was like, oh, it's Christmas, let's watch the Doctor Who special with my family, blah, blah, blah. And, like, I didn't know who Nardal was. I barely knew who Bill was. I was very confused as to why Oswin was like, no, Clara. Why Clara was filmed on a different day and wasn't in shot with Peter Paul at any point. I was like, this feels like contractual. I don't understand. But after having seen the, you know, the Cybermen episode and the Doctor Falls and all that, and then having it lead into Twice Upon a Time, I actually went back and I watched the ending sequence of Twice Upon a Time again. And I was like, okay, this whole ending sequence thing kind of feels a lot more earned. And like, you do have all of the characters come back, but they also don't, because none of them are really there. And it's like, you know, you have the whole, it's a glass android thing that collects all of human experience so it can simulate anybody perfectly, etc., etc. And I was like, this is actually a really good way of having that send-off moment.
Yeah.
But because one of the things I really fucking hated
about David Tennant's reward.
Yeah, the thing that he got to go and see every single companion, even though he's meant to be dying of radiation sickness.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, let's go back and just gleefully take pride in the fact that, like, oh, it's fine that, like, fucking Donna never got to be a Time Lady or be significant because she got her memories wiped and got married to a rich man, which is much better than having the
she didn't get married to a rich, she got married to a nice man, and then the doctor gave them a winning lottery
ticket. Fuck off. Just fuck. So hollow.
Yeah.
So meaningless, because it had nothing to do with the plot or the characters that we'd actually been invested in.
Mm.
In the show, Donna's whole deal is that she never believed in herself and never thought she was significant. And then the ending was, she did become incredibly significant and do stuff. And then they were like, and now we're going to take away everything that you've learned! And I was like, this is ghoulish. It is horrendous. And then the absolute nerve to go and just like, I'll watch her wedding from a distance and give them money, and that makes it okay? Because this is for me. It's not what she wants. I'm like, fuck you. Whereas the Capaldi one, yes, you got the kind of like saccharine-ish like fan service moment of getting to see Bill, Nardole and the Doctor interact one more time. And that was nice, but it was also done in a way that within the, you know, text of the show was ultimately artificial, and it felt earned because it was like, you know, you have the Doctor say like, but you're not really here.
Yeah.
And acknowledge the fact that this isn't how it really was. This isn't what happened to you guys. Bill's fucking dead.
Yeah.
We're just going to pretend the whole water that was fucking stupid. That was fucking stupid. But, like, because in which case, if she's there, can't she just come back? Because she can go anywhere. You know, and Nardole is presumably dead in a black hole, maybe. Yeah. I don't know, it's unclear. But, like, he acknowledges the fact that that kind of fan service moment has to be contrived.
Mm.
And I liked the fact that they took the time to create a contrived thing that was, by the very nature of the show even itself, was like, this is a bit, like, ridiculous that you're trying to pretend that these people are here for this moment for the Doctor to say goodbye, but they're not. And they never were. And he did actually die alone. And I was like, that's more real.
Yeah.
And so you got that thing of having that fan service, like, oh, yeah. And then you're also like, oh, but also,
I never looked at it in that way before.
Yeah.
That's quite an astute observation.
Thank you.
Because now I'm thinking as well, like there's another similar moment that Stephen Moffat did of that kind of fan service, where it was in Matt Smith's Regeneration, and he's in the TARDIS with Clara and doing his speech about how you know, there's like, you've got to look back so long as, because to move forward and stuff. Which I like that more than David Tennant's, because the problem with that whole reward scene spent a lot of time basically going, oh, look at all the stuff we're losing and leaving behind.
Look how sad it is that David Tennant isn't going to be there anymore.
And then he says, oh, I don't want to go. And then Matt Smith appears. It's like, is everyone excited to come with me now?
Yeah.
And everyone's like, no, we're too sad. We won't watch your series.
We want this. We lost our sexy Doctor Who. full credit to David Tennant. He did like do wonders for raising the profile of Doctor Who as a franchise. But when
Matt Smith regenerates, yeah, he's in the TARDIS with Clara, and there's a, like, in the middle of his speech, he sees a vision of Amy Pond. Karen Gillan comes back wearing a wig because she was playing Nebula.
Yeah.
Matt Smith was also wearing a wig that episode because he shaved his head for another film he'd been in. And I have been told that they did not swap wigs, which was a wasted opportunity. But yeah, so she comes back for basically one shot.
Yeah.
And she comes down, puts it like, and says, Raggedy Man, goodnight. And it turns out, no, she's not really there. And that is a kind of nice moment in that it is acknowledging the legacy of this era of the story. Yeah. And they make a whole point, oh, this is the first face that this face saw. Like, oh, Amy Pond is important to this iteration of the Doctor because they spent 2.5 series together.
Yeah.
And that was where the story began. But as much as I don't actually, like, enjoy the rest of the story very much of his final story, it is still, you know, quite intelligent on Stephen Moffat's part to sort of have that sort of fan service moment without it dominating the story.
Yeah, and without actually bringing Amy there.
Yes.
It's like, this is what the Doctor wanted at this time, so his brain, as he's freaking out from regeneration, goes, oh, look, and he's like, oh, you know, and it's a moment of, it's real, and it's something that means something. Again, we come back to it meaning something to the characters. Yeah.
And because, like you can also, like, you can have the character there, but then it has to be about that.
Hmm.
And look at another David Tennant.
Look, Rose has got a big gun now, and I'm just like,
that's not necessarily the best example, although at least it was about that. I think the best example is when they brought back Sarah Jane, who is, like, that's clearly fan service. Like, her beloved character from the classic series comes back to the new series, clearly there to be, like, for classic fans of the series, to be like, look, it's a continuation of this character that you like. But that episode was about her.
Yeah.
And also about, I mean, people complain about this now, as always, it's a shame that these two companions spend the whole episode bitching at each other, and why can't they support each other? Okay, yeah, sure, but we'd never had a Doctor Who story before, which has examined how does an old companion feel about being replaced, and how does a new companion feel about being confronted with that with the reality that has happened?
And that's fan service employed. That's an interesting thing, because it's using fan service as plot, but it's actually analyze. You know, that is the relationship between old Who fans and new Who fans in microcosm, of them being like, oh, you don't understand all the history and legacy of the stuff from the 70s, little child. And the little child's going, I mean, you just seem kind of weird and mean. But I also, like, I want to take part, but also I don't give a shit about your stuff, old man. You know, it's like,
and
it's a way of commenting on the fans. It's saying a thing beyond of jingling the keys, as it were, of going, look, it's a thing you like.
And I like that more as well, because you can sell it by saying what it is.
Yeah.
Like, the trailer for that episode is Sarah Jane comes back.
Yeah.
Because it's like, this is the story we wanted to tell, and so that is what is going at the forefront of this story.
Yeah.
Like, that's how we're pitching it, because that's the pitch, that's the episode.
Hmm.
Whereas, like, if you imagine if it had been done in that sort of fan service-y way, trying to preserve that moment of surprise, then, oh, the story has to be about something else as well, because that's what the trailer needs to be, but then you can't use any of the shots that Elizabeth Sladen is in. We have to hide her in a coat every time she comes into the studio, so make sure that no one knows she's there. And Doctor Who has done that sort of thing. Like, they did the same thing. They wanted Catherine Tate to be a surprise when she first appeared in the show.
Yeah.
But they filmed one scene with her and put that at the end of an episode, and that was basically a trailer for, we're going to do the episode with Catherine Tate.
Yeah. I think that I've just thought that this reminds me of is that this was one of the challenges of actually of going back to comics again, specifically Marvel and DC, is because Marvel and DC have the problem that they have, it's always ongoing, it never stops. And it's always, you know, it's the same characters, but it's wildly different writers, wildly different tones. And having any lasting change happen in those mediums is incredibly difficult. And, like, history is littered with things where people are like, and this one for real is for real the real time, where this definitely happened and there's no changing it at all. And then another writer goes, well, that doesn't fit with anything that I want to do. I'm going to say that this part and this part, they didn't happen in the way that you think. And you get a lot of retcons and stuff like that. Like, the classic example to go to is, like, the history of Hawkman. Like, Hawkman continuity is fucking impossible now. It's like, no one knows what Thanagar actually really is supposed to be anymore. Because it's been retconned so many times, like, he's a guy with the powers of a hawk. He's an alien from an alien world where hawks exist, but also he's actually a genetic experiment from a thing, and Thanagar was a lie, but also it's a real place, but also then he went there, and it's just like, it's a hydra. It's terrifying. But the thing is everyone wants to have, like, fan service type moments.
Yes.
You know, they want to, you know, the thing that happened in like the sort of early to mid 2000s was, especially with DC, was, you know, which coined the phrase event fatigue, where every couple of, like, felt like every fucking month, DC was like, oh, some new massive crisis is coming. Buy all of the tie-in issues, please, with Infinite Crisis, Crisis on Crisis World. Oh no, it's the rebirth, and now there's the you know, and there was a lot of them going, I think it was KRL from the Ballin' Out Super Podcast said, yeah, DC's approach is just like, is this working? No? Okay, hit the reset button. Just redo everything. Maybe this time we'll get some stuff to stick, even though they've got, like, literally nearly 100 years of material they can draw upon for stuff. But it's this idea that everyone wants to have, like, their moment with the characters. And, like, stuff like the moment where Wolverine got his adamantium ripped out of his body by Magneto, right?
Mm.
Iconic moment. Absolutely brilliant, because it was one of the first times that the readers would just say, oh, fuck, he doesn't have his metal bones anymore.
Yeah.
What does that mean? And it meant, like, a whole bunch of things. Like, you know, he was weaker as a character now. Like, he couldn't cut through anything. He was, you know, he took damage more often and stuff. And it was a fundamental change. Eventually, he got the boat. It came back.
Yeah.
Because eventually, well, he needs to have the atom. It's one part of the character. That's the idea of what a Wolverine is to have the metal bones. And it's this sense that you want to try and have your impactful moments for the period of your run. But the problem with Marvel and DC Comics is that they have so much stuff in the back of just like, oh, there was the recent run on Silver Surfer where they decided that they wanted him to have a companion, very Doctor Who-ish actually, where he gets, I can't remember her name. She dressed in Ladybird colours and stuff, and she and Norrin Rad went on a bunch of these, like, you know, sort of very Doctor Who sci-fi, slightly goofy tone adventure stuff. And it ended up with, like, spoilers for this run of Silver Surfer, I guess. It ends up, like, she, like, dies, but then he ends up going back to the beginning of time and writing her into the very fabric of the universe. So it's, like, the creation of the Kirby dot effect, which is, like, the energy effect that you see in comics a lot, which was created by Jack Kirby, because she always wore dots. It's like this whole, it's a way to tie in a stylistic thing from, like, you know, decades worth of comics, and like, oh, this is actually a manifestation of the Silver Surfer having changed the universe at the beginning of time to be a thing. And I'm like, that's dumb. I mean, it's fine, you know, for the context of the run. I'm like, yeah, okay, this makes sense and it's quite nice, but also like, I don't know how I meant. I, you know, I like Kirby dots. I think they're really cool. It's a really cool stylistic thing that you see a lot, and it's great. I didn't need that to be a lady.
Yeah.
You know, it didn't add anything for me reading that to be like, oh, and the Kirby dots were her all along.
Yeah.
I'm like, I liked the characters and I liked what they did, but I feel like you tried to tie it too hard to history.
Yeah.
In a way. It's like trying too hard. I don't know.
Yeah, no,
it's a fine line to walk.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know where I heard this as well, but I thought there was, someone was talking about, I don't know if this is just fan speculation, but someone was talking about them, like, making the next Star Wars trilogy would be another prequel series back to the early days of the Jedi, and it would explain where the Force came from. And my reaction was, no!
No!
No, you don't.
No,
even,
don't
do you
that.
Not remember midichlorians and how angry everyone was about that?
Also, it's just like, who the fuck cares?
Like, that's, yeah, it's like, the Force is just the Force. It's just the magic that's existed since the dawn of the universe. We don't, that's all the explanation you need. It's just an excuse for your space wizards to have space wizard powers.
Well, it's like the phrase that I've heard thrown around by like mostly like left you people talking about the sort of more bad faith approaches to understanding and processing media. It's like no narrative, only lore. And I'm just like, yeah, sometimes it do get a bit like that.
Yeah.
And that's
the thing. Yeah, I think there's that element of like thinking that because fans are always interested in backstory and lore and so often like that leads to, oh, we'll tell a story about the lore and the backstory, and that sometimes can work.
Mm-hmm.
But I always generally think, like, when people, oh, we need a story about, like, oh, this time in their life, and then it's like, But no, that was never written to be a story. That's just an explanation for where the character is now.
Yeah.
And that doesn't necessarily make a good story, because normally, for a story to work, generally, you want your main character to be in a different position at the beginning as they were when as they end up in.
They want an arc. They go on a journey and they change and they grow.
And often, like, backstory, like, doesn't necessarily lend itself to that, especially if you already know what the ending is or what the end result is.
Yeah.
So generally, it works, I think, when you start off, you get your main character and put them in a and say, actually, at the beginning, they were completely in a completely unexpected place. You would not expect to find this character here. Like, we've rebooted Tomb Raider, and Lara Croft says, oh, I hate tombs. And he's like, what? Lara Croft says she hates tombs? How
but
can that
be? She's the Tomb Raider.
And then we see, oh, she goes on an experience to be, and oh, this is how she... Yeah, so in that sense, it can work, although that wasn't a prequel, that was a reboot.
But again, it's this notion that the danger with prequel stuff, when especially if it's close enough to have prequels of characters that we already know who they are.
Yeah.
It's like, well, we know where this is going.
Yes.
And it lowers the sense of engagement, because you're sort of like... Like, a good example, I think, of this is that there's a manga series called Magi Labyrinth of Magic, which mm-hmm. is very good. And in that series, Sinbad, the ruler of the Seven Seas, is like this big, powerful king figure who's like united a bunch of countries together in a republic. And he's like one of the three major superpowers that helps govern the world. And he's charismatic, kind of goofy, also insanely powerful, and just a little bit dangerous. And you sort of like, you know, he's the sort of sexy, dangerous guy. He's like, oh, fool. And he's like super accomplished and has like five different magical djinns that like, you know, all do his bidding and stuff. And then the author wrote The Legend of Sinbad. And you see him start off from piss, dirt, nothing. And you know where he's going. But it's like, okay, so I know the rough gimmick of how it goes and everything like that. And I know roughly who the crew is. Mm. But seeing him meet those people and like the decisions that were taken, you know, that led him to become this big, all-powerful figure. It is engaging, but you still know where it's going.
Yeah.
So I've never been able to necessarily... Like, I've read all of Magi, like, multiple times. Mm. I think it's brilliant. I've tried to read The Legend of Sinbad a bunch of times, but I just end up sliding off it, because I'm just like, what?
That's the thing. I think often backstory just isn't as interesting as story. And there's... Mm. By design, because...
It's in the background.
And so often I think fans often want, oh, this is interesting because the way that fans consume media and the way that I've done, where you get sort of obsessive and sort of, oh, I want to find out as much about this as I can, and then you get into the backstory and into the weeds and you think like, oh, we need, like, oh, wouldn't it be great to have a story about this? And the answer is not necessarily.
I think the thing that's often confused is that backstory can be very, very potent, but I think it has to be used as part of the main narrative that you're telling. So, use Steven Universe, for example.
Yeah.
The backstory of Rose Quartz is utterly integral to the story of Steven Universe.
We couldn't have a Rose Quartz series.
No, exactly. And, like, what, we wouldn't want that.
No.
Like, that would... Like, you... Maybe, like, a special? But even then, I'm like, what's the point?
Yeah.
It's, like, the interesting stuff of that backstory. That backstory only really, really matters because of the story it impacts on the characters in the primary text.
Yes.
We, as the audience, might find a backstory episode, like, well, a backstory special or something interesting, but no one in the text of the backstory would find it as interesting as we, the audience.
Yeah.
Because it's intertextual fan service. Well, we did it, full circle.
Well,
with 2.5 minutes to go, I'm a fucking genius.
I mean, not exactly, because it's still it's referencing itself rather than another text. It would be more like...
Well, yeah, but it's... Well, I mean, like, arguably, like, you know... Technically, the Khanna example still stands, because in the text of J.J. Abrams' Star Trek, Khan as a concept does exist in another universe, and Leonard Nimoy have the whole, well, Khan, he was a badass and was cool and sexy. He's one bad mother mamma jamma.
Yeah, sure, but I'm still, like, it is still referencing a text that they did not write.
It's true, yeah.
It's still about that, like, it's assuming, like, the thing I worry about these sort of, like, I don't worry, because, like, you're making your money, you're fine. But I sort of look at it and just wonder, like, how will we, like, just imagine, like, someone who's not familiar, like, how will this survive the test of time? How will this be regarded in, like, 50 years, where people watch it and go, who's Khan? We've made 50 Khan films by then. Yeah, so
the enduring Khan brand.
That's the thing. It's because it's very highly dependent on the context of the audience viewing it, and I know that's true of all media and art in some degree, but it's very it assumes not necessarily that you have you have seen or read this other text, but that you are familiar enough with the culture of it.
You know, the unfortunate reading of this is if you're a young kid and you've never heard of the Wrath of Khan movies and stuff. From your perspective, it's Benedict Cumberbatch. Maybe he's... Because he's maybe there's more to this John Harrison guy.
Yeah.
And then he turns around, actually, I have a non-white name. And that's when you know he's a baddie!
That's the thing. If you're not familiar with that, that's all it... Yeah, it just falls completely flat.
Yeah, it's meaningless. It's like, oh, he's called Khan, is he?
Yeah, and it's just what am I supposed to do with that information?
Yeah.
And that's why I think if you don't have that... if it's not aimed at the right audience, then it's just doesn't work.
Yeah, and it's also within the text of the thing itself. They don't know what a Khan is. And
yeah.
Well, yeah. So we got 12 seconds left, Jim. Any last words? Before I shoot you.
What is interesting is that you have I thought I was against fan service in general, but you have at least pointed out examples of where I think the intertextual fan service can work.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think generally what bothers me is more and more in lots of different ways, but in this way particularly, that why can't we just call a fish a fish? I don't know if that's the saying, but why can't we just call a
it's
thing
A spade is the that's
sure.
the proper one.
But I mean, it applies to fish as well. Why can't we just call the thing what it is instead of I know a lot of marketing is a kind of deception. But I prefer it saying this is the story we want to tell, and then the audience goes, oh, that's a story we want to watch, and then they watch it rather than just being oh, do you want this story? And they go, yeah, well, actually it's this story, and they're oh. And then
just very quickly, because I'm aware we're out of time, this reminds me a bit of the marketing for Terminator Genesis, which is the opposite problem, where I saw the very first trailer and I was that looks bananas, but also okay, I'm already in. And then the next two trailers after that revealed massive plot points, and I was no, what? Why? What? You didn't need to show me any of this. I was already now when those moments happen in it, because the revelation that John Connor is a Terminator, actually that's pretty cool.
Yes.
It's a good moment, but the problem is everyone knew.
But that's different because that's not a better example, because that's just revealing a revealing a plot twist or something in a trailer.
Yeah, but it's
the
opposite side to misdirection.
A better example is how we talked about these episodes where Peter Capaldi's last episodes where and that's where John Sims' master came back, and that's clearly a fan service moment because it's this old character who was disguised as someone else and then appeared, but they spoiled that because they added a trailer at the end of the first episode revealing that John Sim was coming back.
Oh, did they?
Yeah. And it just leaves you.
Well,
imagine what that moment would have been if we didn't know that John... Because he'd been this in disguise this whole time, and even when we knew...
I didn't know.
Yeah, I didn't clock him. And then it was it's only when... Oh, fuck, that was John Sim in prosthetics.
Because we were watching it, and I was going, man, this actor's really good.
Yeah, and when I was showing it to you, I was just please don't ask me who he is, or to pull up his IMDb.
Yeah.
There's an example of that is an absolutely intertextual fan service moment because you need to be familiar with John Sim's master in order for that moment to land.
Hmm.
They called a fish a fish. I'm hashtagging it and I'm making
it's
it
a spade a spade. That's what it is. That's the phrase.
No,
called a spade a spade.
But then they revealed that was what they were going to do. They advertised that. Oh, this is the story we want to tell.
Jim, I'm going to have to stop you because we are out of time.
We are out of time.
And
but
we can't waste any more of the.
But we just found an example where I'm arguing against myself.
You could keep this up all day, and then that would truly be
a waste of time.
Wigging out. And that's an intertextual fan service, because if you don't listen to Wigging Out, you're like, what the fuck is
that? That means nothing to you. What a Waste of Time featured the voices of me, Jim Woodall,
and Nick Hurd. Music by Anthony Bullinger.